Welcome to the Chris Yeh Podcast. I am, as always, Chris Yeh. And today, Scott Johnson and I will be conducting another set of Blitz scalability analyses of venture deals, this time for deals from December 2020. I hope you enjoy. Hello, and welcome to the inaugural, official Blitz Scaling Ventures Podcast. I'm Chris Yeh, and I'm joined by my general partner at Blitz Scaling Ventures, Scott Johnson.
Hello, Chris. Great to be here for this inaugural podcast, as you point out. But we've really done a bunch of these just under the Chris Yeh Podcast until now, but we got a close done on our fund. And so now we can officially launch this podcast under the Blitz Scaling Ventures flag.
Very exciting, Scott. And again, great to have you as a partner in this and so many other adventures.
Yeah, so let's get going. We've got a bunch of companies to talk about today. There are four of them that we're talking about, and these are deals that we have looked at in December. And what we do every month is we examine all of the deals that the top VCs do and pull out the ones that we think are the most Blitz scalable, and we score them with our 100-point scoring system. We have an algorithm that surfaces the ones that are most likely to be Blitz scalable. And we go over that scoring, and that's what we're going to do with these four companies. And the first one we're going to start with is Rec Room. So, Chris, you want to describe what Rec Room is?
Yeah, so Rec Room, we've described very loosely as the VR Roblox. What it is it's an online universe where you can play and, more importantly, create games with friends. And so people are out there creating rooms right now. Now, it's a little different from Roblox in the sense that Roblox, these are actual video games. In the case of Rec Room, it's more of a VR environment that may have game-like elements, but could also just be an art project or a place for people to gather. And what's very important is it's not just purely VR. So yes, if you have an Oculus Quest or something like that, you can use this, but it's also something that you can use on your Xbox, on your PS5, and on your iOS devices. So it's a mainstream, not just limited to people with VR headsets kind of deal.
Yes, but it still falls in the social network. Don't you think it's still a social network if you had to classify it?
Absolutely. It's in the category of social networks that are not just purely one-to-one, but ones where people have the opportunity to author. You can sort of think of this analogy of a rec room as a bit like a Facebook group, a place where somebody who sets up the group can be the proprietor, but where people are really gathering to interact with each other.
Right. And they've shown some incredible growth. They did a Series C. The investors in here are, you know, quality investors, right? We have Index, we have Sequoia, we have Madrona. It's a Seattle company, so you expect the best Seattle VC to be in there. And sure enough, there's Madrona. First Round Capital is in here as well, which is a premier seed fund. So top tier investors and some great growth. And gotta have taken a little bit of inspiration from Ready Player 2 that's about to come out. So, you know, a lot of interest in what's going to be the VR environment that wins and sort of is the social network that you enter when you put on that VR mask and enter a different world. And I guess Rec Room is the first of those contenders, and they seem to have gotten a lot of traction. I forget the numbers, Chris. We just looked at them.
10 million. They have 10 million members so far.
Yeah, so that's not daily active users, obviously, but the 10 million people have signed up to be part of this environment. So they are exploding, and that's what blitzscaling companies do. So let's run down the scoring. If you recall, the seven things we look at are the winner take mostness of the dynamics of the company. So is this a situation where the winner's going to take most, or are there going to be lots of winners here? And if it's winner take most, that's a good thing in our scoring. If it's next up is viral growth or distribution, you know, can they really explode quickly? Is this something that's going to take years and years and years and lots of money, or is it something that's going to happen really fast without a lot of money? And so we measure that. Then we measure product market fit, market size, gross margin, organizational scalability, and operation scalability. And then we apply a black box algorithm to come up with a final score. So each of those elements, we score 1 to 10. And we start with the two most important, winner take most and viral growth or rapid distribution. So we'll start with winner take most, Chris. How do you think about Rec Room for this?
So as you recall, we refer to this as a bit like a VR Roblox, and there's a very strong winner-take-most dynamic because, first of all, you have a community element where people are coming and joining in. Second, there's a marketplace dynamic where you have people who are content creators and content consumers coming together. And finally, you have something that acts as a platform, the standard way where things are done, where games are built or where VR environments are built. And so all those are different network effects. And when you combine the three of them together, you really have a strong winner-take-most market. So we're giving it a 10 out of 10. Again, not saying that it's guaranteed that Rec Room will win the market, but the market will probably be won by a single player.
But that's what we said for Roblox, and yet here we are talking about Rec Room. So how can they coexist?
Well, you think about it, they have slightly different emphases. So Roblox is a video game environment, and it's primarily focused on people playing on mobile, and they're 2D games. They're not virtual reality games. Whereas Rec Room is focused on VR environments, where every person in the environment is actually interacting with all these different objects, and where it's not necessarily a game itself. There could be game mechanics, but there might not be. So it's slightly different emphases, and we see this happen. If you think about something like an eBay or a Craigslist, these are the OG marketplaces, and they're still really important, but people have been able to build so many different marketplaces around specific verticals or specific use cases. So you have a general platform, but then you have the ability to build more specialized platforms, and that's where Roblox and Rec Room really come to play.
Yeah, good. Okay, so that's helpful. So we gave it a 10, right? I mean, we just said that, look, this is really strong winner-take-most game, and there's probably going to be a single winner, maybe two, maybe one in China and one in the US or something. But it's a very strong network effect that's here, and so we're giving it full credit, 10 out of 10. Then we get to, okay, so how fast will it grow?
So when it comes to viral growth or distribution, we're often looking at two different questions. One is how much friction is there to adoption? And the second is to what extent does it leverage existing networks? So with something like Rec Room, the friction to adoption is relatively low. That's helped by the fact that you can use it on iOS and Xbox and PlayStation and other things other than just Oculus. If this were purely an Oculus play, its growth would be definitely inhibited. The other element of it is tapping into some of those social elements. So if you have these environments in which you want to interact with people, you might very well have some virality where you're bringing your friends to those environments to interact with you. So there is definitely some viral or distribution element to it. Now, it's not perfect. Again, this is still something where VR is relatively new. They warn that on iOS that the environments are not going to be as high definition. It's not going to work quite as smoothly. So there is some friction there. We ended up giving them an 8 out of 10, which is good, but not great.
Okay, so a 10 and an 8 so far. And that's, you know, that's enough. Those are the two most important elements. And if you have a 10 and an 8, then you could be a blitzscaler if you do well the rest of the way. So let's look at that all-important element for social networks, product market fit. Generally, social networks score really well in our blitzscaling scoring. They're usually in the 90s. If they have strong product market fit, then they're in the high 90s. So that's but if they don't, then they're really not blitzscalable. So this is really the key. This is where everything hinges for social networks normally. And we don't know. We haven't spent hours and hours and hours using the product, but from our initial looking at the product and understanding how it works, what do you think?
Well, I think one of the things that the folks at Rec Room have done a good job of is previewing for people sort of what the experience is. So they show these screenshots of these environments. You can see the different things that are in those environments. So for example, I saw a number of screenshots that involved the Five Nights at Freddy's video game franchise, something I'm aware of because my son is an enthusiastic fan. And it gives you some indication of the kinds of things that people are building. Those screenshots also include the various chat logs of people going back and forth within those environments. We can see the interactions happening, that people are pinging back and forth. So those are all pretty good things. That being said, it's still at a very early stage, and you know, it's not clear that this is something that is truly addictive. This is something where people return day after day after day. Is it something they pop in for novelty purposes? Do they go from room to room, or do they pick a room and really go and stay there and take part in it extensively and regularly? So jury's still out on product market fit. We can learn more by experiencing it ourselves, but this first screen, we're doing it just based on the externally available information. So we gave it a 7. That's a provisional score, and we can install Rec Room on our iOS devices and play around with it a little bit and see more. We've talked before about Clubhouse, which is the audio social network. That was something where it was difficult to tell what the product market fit was from the outside. I've actually been using it for the past week or so, and it's interesting. I'm still not convinced that the long-term product market fit is there, given the way that the content is currently being run. But it definitely has achieved a certain kind of product market fit in the sense it's got a lot of people who are addicted and regular users. So this is an interesting thing to watch. And when we have some personal experience with Rec Room, we may end up coming back and updating the score.
Yeah, and this is a good time to remind our listeners why it is that this is different from a video game. Typically, a video game has a lot of social elements to it. It can grow really fast. It can be super viral. But it's not sort of long-term sticky. People move from game to game. And so your game is, it kind of plays out. Whereas something like Roblox, which is a platform for games, does not. So, and the Rec Room, I think, is more like Roblox. It's a platform for games, and there will be a constant refresh of the content. And, you know, as we pointed out, it's user-generated content. So that has to be good enough to keep people coming back. And that's the question mark here, really. A lot of it's, you know, can they create a platform so that the users themselves can create content that is so compelling, people keep coming back? And is the community element so compelling that people keep coming back? And, you know, are you meeting new people and enjoying it? And every time it's a fresh experience and you love it. That's hard to do. So if they're getting that right, and if they're nailing it, and their early returns, like 10 million is a lot of people to show up at something that kind of sucks. So I think they're probably doing a great job. We just have to use it to figure it out.
Exactly. And again, the whole purpose of this scoring system is as a filtering system. And before we actually invest as Blitzscaling Ventures, we do true due diligence where we're actually interacting with the CEO and the management team and really understanding more deeply what the company does. But nonetheless, if a company does not appear like it could be Blitzscalable, why bother talking with it?
Yeah, important point. This conversation Chris and I are having, this is a screening conversation. This is not a final judgment on a company by any means. All right, moving on. Market size. What do you think?
Yeah, so market size, it just seems like VR is the future. Someday it's going to be adopted by everyone. This is going to be a 10 out of 10. Now, exactly the time frame on that, hard to say, but without a question, this is going to be the future.
Sure, definitely agree. Gross margin, you know, again, this is software. It's scale. It's going to have high gross margins no matter what the business model is. It's going to be scalable both organizationally and operationally. So when I talk about those, I mean the people and then the logistics of operating the business. Those are both very scalable. At full credit there. So the final score is 10, 8, 7, 10, 10, 10 on the elements that make up our scoring algorithm. A lot of tens there. And the final score is 82, which is awesome. So anything above 80 is rare, unusual, and wonderful. So this is definitely a Blitzscalable company. And if they can figure out their viral growth, like really enhance that somehow, and then prove to us the product market fit is better than, you know, earns better than a 7, then that score could go up significantly. So this is one to get pretty excited about.
Absolutely. And again, that's just the first step. The next step from here, as Blitzscaling Ventures goes, is to reach out to the CEO, begin the discussions, and we may very well report back in the future and talk about what we eventually decided to do with various companies.
Right. And now we're going to enter the beauty segment of our podcast. Believe it or not, we have a beauty segment this month. And coincidentally, there are two companies in the cosmetics space that caught our attention and are pretty exciting. So let's go into the beauty segment, Chris, something you and I know a ton about because we have daughters who and we've seen them spend on these products. And so we don't know as much, obviously, as some people, but
well, speak for yourself, Scott. I have to see my colorist every week, otherwise things fall apart.
All right. So we all know it's important for everybody to try to look their best. So this is, you know, these are big market opportunities. And we'll turn first to a company called Beauty Pie, which is, I think, a play on Cutie Pie. I'm just guessing. But Beauty Pie is a place where they want to bring the world's best beauty products at factory costs. So the, as you know, the cosmetics market is a market where the underlying cost of the product you use is 5 cents and you've just paid $50 for it. And all that markup is both in the channel and in the marketing. And so through the glossy magazines that are devoted to these products that make a lot of money writing about fashion, all that margin goes to those to that marketing. And it's expensive to try to create a brand around cosmetics. And so you're paying for a lot of marketing when you buy those things. And Beauty Pie said, well, maybe you don't have to, you know, maybe we should just sort of strip away all that marketing, sell the quality stuff and do it directly to consumers. Let's see if that can work.
Absolutely. I think that this is a fascinating business model. I really compare it to the Costco business model, where Costco, in fact, makes almost all of its profits off of its membership fees, not off the products it sells. Costco actually works to sell their products for as close to cost as possible, and their profitability comes from the fact that people know this and trust them and therefore pay the overall annual membership fees. And the other interesting parallel here is that so much of what Costco sells now is its Kirkland signature brand, its own internal brand, where you have these high quality products that are manufactured by the same manufacturers with the giant brands, but who, because of the massive volume of Costco, are willing to actually sell what is essentially the same product under Costco's label for far less. So I feel like that is a good analogy for what's happening with Beauty Pie. Now, in terms of the market, there's a couple of reasons why this is a winner-take-most market. So the first, of course, is that there is a marketplace element. Beauty Pie is not making these products. It is bringing these products from manufacturers to consumers. And so as Beauty Pie increases in scale, it becomes more and more attractive for those manufacturers to sell their products, much like Costco is attractive for manufacturers to sell their products. And conversely, as Beauty Pie adds more and more manufacturers and has more and more products to choose from, it becomes more and more of a one-stop shop for the beauty shopper. So there is a strong winner-take-most element there, and that's from a network effect. But what's interesting is we also have a bit of a land grab. Now, we don't talk about land grabs that much. So often we're focused on the network effect, but land grabs are one of the other ways you can have a winner-take-most market. And the interesting thing about beauty is if you find a beauty product that you use, you are likely to continue using it. All of you may have stories from your own lives, either for yourself or for someone that you know and love, where they found a particular product that really worked well for them, and then they become fiercely loyal to that product. If that product goes out of business, they'll buy a pallet of the product and just keep it around and try to make that product last long enough to last their entire lifetime. So there's extreme loyalty in the beauty market, and that creates a bit of a land grab.
Okay, so we're giving it a 10 out of 10. We've got network effects, we've got a bit of a land grab, and so they're going to get full credit there. So they're
actually, I think we gave them a 9 out of 10, not quite a 10 out of 10, because you can, yes, you can actually switch. You may not like it, but you can switch. But nonetheless, it is still a very strong winner-take-most market.
Yeah, you can switch. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, looking at the wrong row. Okay. Now, viral growth or distribution. How fast can they grow? What's the friction here in growth?
So the amazing thing about this is that they've done a fantastic job on PR and word of mouth. So if there's anything that is driven by PR and word of mouth, it's beauty. The entire fashion magazine industry is based around these darned products. And it is astonishing. If you go to YouTube and you look at the most popular YouTubers and the most popular videos, makeup is one of the huge categories. This is just one of those categories where there's an inherent virality and people love it to death. And then there's all these people who can provide distribution. If they find a brand they like, influencers start talking about it. So this is something, because it's something that is very public, something that people love talking about, we gave this a 9 out of 10. And again, this is something that's just inherent in the product type, the product space.
Okay, so 9 and then a 9 on the two most important elements. Now let's look at the last 5 and see how we do. Product market fit, you know, I just love it when something of super high quality is being sold so close to cost. It just seems to have a very broad appeal when you can get away with that.
Yeah. Now the reason why we didn't give it, and we ended up giving it 8 out of 10, the reason we didn't give it a 9 or 10 out of 10 is there is some friction to overcome. So to order through BeautyPie, you need to be a member. This is the Costco model, right? You can't just waltz into Costco. You need a Costco membership or a friend who has a Costco membership. So the BeautyPie model says that you are going to pay a minimum of either $10 a month or $99 a year to be a member. And there's further levels up and so on and so forth, but that's the bottom line getting in. Now, $99 a year is not insignificant. $10 a month is not insignificant. And we do think that it will impede the product market fit for some folks. There's some folks who will say, you know what, I don't buy enough product, it's not worth it. But I think there's a lot of folks who are going to say, you know what, it is worth it. And then once they've committed and are paying that subscription fee, are going to say, I really need to make this count and make it worthwhile. I need to buy more.
It's so important to get the pricing right. And people think of product market fit and they think, oh, well, we just have to get the product, so it's wonderful. And that is true. You need a product that delights customers. But customers are delighted when they get something that they're loving the price for. And while I love the idea of getting something of high quality at a very, very good price compared to what I'm usually paying, I mean, that's huge savings. Consumers love that. I really don't like this two-tier model. I think, you know, Costco made it work. Can they really do that here? I don't know. I struggle. I mean, you have to be a heavy spender on this stuff to make that worth it. $100 a year. I mean, what's a typical beauty products budget? Are they really going for the people that are spending $4,000 a year on this? So $100,000 just doesn't seem like much. If we were to engage with this company, I would think that we would really dig in on that and explore alternatives and try to find a premium or at least a dollar a month or some sort of intro thing. Like there's got to be a way to enter this without so much friction, because a $99 hurdle feels like a lot to overcome.
And by the way, this is one of those interesting cases where the score is a compromise score between Scott and I, who disagree about how to view this. So Scott, you just heard Scott describe how he thinks that the $99 a year, the $10 a month is way expensive and there should be a $1 a month option. I take the opposite approach. I think that what they're going for is they're going for people who are heavy spenders, people for whom spending $100 on beauty in a single month would be a relatively light expenditure, and where I think that people are far more willing to credit the quality and high-end nature of the products if they do not have a discount pricing structure. Notice it's $10 a month. It's not even $9 a month. It's $10 a month. It's like an expensive restaurant. When you go to an expensive restaurant, they don't list their entree for $9.95. They list it for $10, or rather, since we're talking about an expensive restaurant, $70 or $80. And so they avoid that sense of cheapness. They are trying to convey luxury. And I do think that the amounts they're charging are appropriate. But that is something that we will see play out in the marketplace, of course.
Great. So they can sell their product to everyone that goes to the French Laundry and not to anybody else. I'm
just saying that we're not talking about the people who are buying their beauty products from Walgreens and CVS. We're talking about the people who are going up a notch to Kiehl's or Bath and Body Works, or even people who used to go to department stores when those things existed. So I think it's a couple of steps up.
Okay. Well, we'll see how they do. I just feel like, well, you know how I feel. Let's move on. Market size. So, you know, beauty products is such an enormous market, we shouldn't even talk about it. Gross margin.
10 out of 10. Absolutely.
Yeah, 10 out of 10 for sure. Gross margin. You know, they got to sell stuff. Or so, how are they making their money?
Well, this is something where we're guessing a little bit. Again, I talked about the Costco model, but on the other hand, beauty products are so inherently high margin that they may be able to sell the products at costs that seem absurdly low to the members and still make a 70, 80% gross margin. So we gave them a 9, and again, a little provisional, could very well be a 10.
Could be. We just need to find out more. Again, this is screening. We're not making a definitive judgment here. Organizational scalability, well, they should be able to scale the organization just fine. There's some customer service they'll need to do, but for the most part, that's manageable. So they get full credit there. And then operationally, well, if they're gonna have to ship stuff, then
Exactly. Shipping stuff, managing subscriptions, there is some complexity there. So it's not just trivial. It's not just purely online. We gave it an 8 out of 10.
Right. So the final score is an 80. And so they do make our cutoff. Anything 80 and above, we think is blitz scalable. And that's on the strength of the winner take most and distribution elements here. They do score well there. And those are the two most important elements. Everything else you can either overcome or you can fix it, or it just isn't important enough to say that they can't blitz scale. So 80 is good. And so we like BeautyPie. And to continue the beauty section of this podcast, let's look at Supergrate.
So Supergrate is really interesting. What it is essentially is a review site, but it's also a community, and therefore it's also sort of an e-commerce play. And what it allows people to do is it allows its members to go ahead and record video reviews of various beauty products. So we'd look up a lip gloss and there'd be 200 video reviews, which is pretty remarkable. Now, we all know that reviews are a very powerful thing. And reviews, for example, are one of the ways that Amazon was able to add some network effects to retailing, which previously did not exist. And the big question would be, well, isn't Amazon good enough? I mean, can't you just go to Amazon and see reviews? And the answer is, when it comes to something like beauty, the video review is really powerful. Why do people look at the video reviews? They want to see somebody who has a skin and color that is similar to their own, right? When you read that text-based review in Amazon, they say this worked great for me. For all you know, that person is, 20 years older and a completely different skin tone, has a completely different skin category. And so you look at that and you're like, well, I don't know if this is going to work for me or not. So Supergrate does away with that. It provides reviews in the traditional way, but also each of the reviews is a video review so that you really lean into the appearance element of it. And I think it's just so clever. Now, we look at this and say, well, it's a review site, and therefore having as many reviews as possible matters. It's something where as you attract people in, it's going to make it easier and easier to strike deals with manufacturers and retailers and things like that. So we actually gave this a 10 out of 10 when it came to the winner take most market, because again, there really only needs to be that one big review site.
Right. And just backing up a little, I forgot to mention that the BeautyPie was a Series A, and the investors there were General Catalyst and Index Venture, and that's located in London. And this is also, Supergrate is also a Series A deal, and Benchmark is the lead here. And they did a $6.5 million round, and these are December deals, so it's a recent round. And 6.5 is sort of a smaller A round these days, and this company's in New York.
Well, fortunately, they don't have a lot of operations. They've been able to do this in a very lean way. They have a relatively small team. And what's interesting about Supergrate, and this is something that Scott and I noticed when I looked them up on LinkedIn, its founders are male. And that's a little unusual in the beauty space, but they've been successful at doing other things. And, they're off to a great start here. Now, the next category besides winner take most is viral growth or distribution. And here, again, really good marks on viral growth and distribution. So if you think about it, you have people who are creating video reviews, so they're promoting it themselves. You have this element of people who want to be influencers saying, I'm going to build up my reputation here on Supergrate. So that's great. And then from a distribution standpoint, it may very well be that in the future, because they have these reviews, the people who are the manufacturers or distributors of these products will say, well, if you want to see what it looks like, it's 10 out of 10 on Supergrate, and you can see the video reviews there, just like you see people advertising their product saying 4.9 on Amazon. So I think that there's a lot of good viral growth and distribution possibilities here. 9 out of 10.
Right. So a 10 and a 9, a strong start for sure. And if they get the other elements right, then we could be in the 80s. Let's see how they do. Product market fit. We tried the product and we love the potential for where product market fit could be one day, but they're just getting going. And we actually found some bugs in the search, and the search was, you know, definitely could be better, because do you really want to see 200 lip gloss products that aren't sorted in any way? And really, you know, the only way to sort it is how many people have reviewed it. And is that really a good proxy for quality? And then there aren't any stars on the reviews really. So it's got a long way to go, I think, to really achieve the goal of helping people figure out which products are super great. So that's, you know, that's my view, Chris. What do you think?
No, I agree with you. And again, I think that this is something where we're on the outside looking in. Maybe they've got good reasons for all the things that they do, but that's something we'll find out if we decide it's worth contacting them. But again, as you mentioned, we did a search. It was broken. When you look at the reviews, you have 150 video reviews. You don't know which ones to look at. I mean, I guess you could look at the person's face and say, let me listen to that one. But as you mentioned, Scott, there's no starring. There's no numerical rating system. It just feels like it's not yet fully optimized.
Exactly. So we gave it a 6 because it's still good. I mean, it's still really good, but it's just got a long way to go. But that's, you know, that's typical for a company that's just getting their Series A. So we're optimistic that they're going to really figure that out and get that score up in the near future. Market size, again, we're in beauty products. So that's a 10 out of 10. And gross margin, what do you think the business model is here, Chris?
Yeah, so it's a little hard to tell, but what we can see is that they use affiliate links in all their products. This is the Pinterest model, and they're not holding any inventory. They just make money when people buy stuff. So that is a 10 out of 10 on gross margin.
Good. Okay, so we're down to scalability, and you know, it's a website, it scales. So then organizationally and operationally, we're not worried about scaling here, very little friction to growth. What they have to do is grow their marketplace as fast as they can and figure out the product market fit. And that's hyper focus on those two things, and they can build a really, really nice business. So the overall score here is a very good 85. And that's despite a reasonably low score in product market fit. So I think, you know, that could go up higher. And we think Benchmark made a smart bet here. So we're hopeful that these guys are going to go far. So
it's video Pinterest for beauty. I mean, just think about that. That's pretty clearly valuable.
Okay, that is the end of our beauty segment. And I don't think we'll ever have another beauty segment. So that may be the first and only and last beauty segment that we have in our Blitzscaling Ventures podcast, but really enjoyed it. And let's move on to Storyboard.
Yeah, so this is what I want to talk about. Storyboard did not make the cut for Blitz scalability. We're going to tell you that up front, but we're also going to tell you why it's so interesting and where we think things might go from there. We'll see. So what Storyboard does is it makes it very easy to create podcasts within the enterprise. So this is something that I talk to corporations and other folks about all the time. I tell them, listen, you know, one of the most important things that you can do as leadership is to find a way to convey what you're thinking and what's going on, to have that human touch with all the members of the organization. And there are a lot of great examples of people who do this. So Brian Chesky over at Airbnb writes an email to the entire company every Sunday. Angela Ahrens, when she was at Apple, would record videos on her iPhone and then make them available to her team. But one of the ways that would really make a ton of sense is podcasts, because podcasts are something which are now mainstream. A lot of people listen to podcasts on a regular basis. And if you had a podcast that was from your CEO or from the leader of your organization, and they were talking about what was important, that's something that could easily fit into the daily commute, that could fit into your walking the dog or what have you. And you're picking stuff up, you're developing that kind of relationship. And the thing we note about podcasting is it's really intimate. You're hearing someone's voice in your ear. It tends to produce a real emotional connection. So this is a concept that I've thought should exist for a long time. I've off and on tried to convince other people to do it and said this is something that should exist and it would be successful as a business. And lo and behold, Storyboard is doing it, and it's a CRV deal. And again, I think it's a great idea. But the interesting question is it Blitz scalable?
Well, let's look at that. And I should mention it's a seed round, so they're still pretty early in their evolution. Just to set people's expectations on how mature the product is. But go ahead, Chris, winner take most, what do you think?
Yeah, so from a winner take most perspective, there actually is some decent winner take most element to it. And again, as we saw before, it is a bit of a land grab. And the reason is, if you think about podcasts right now, once you add the podcast to your podcatcher, do you stop using it? Do you ever change them? Maybe. You may unsubscribe, but most people just subscribe and keep adding. So there's a real inertia that exists. And let's say that Storyboard comes into the company and the company goes ahead and creates these Storyboard podcasts and they have the employees sign up for them. And then they want to go ahead and switch to a new platform. Well, now they got to get the employees to install a new app and develop a new habit. And it's really kind of a pain. So I would say that there's a strong land grab element to it. And ultimately, I felt that was worth enough to get them to a 9 on winner take most.
Yeah, and it's unusual that we rely on the land grab as the thing that drives a high score in this element. And so you should point that out, that it's not often that it's a land grab. And really, enterprise software, which this is fundamentally, usually is not a land grab. Usually there's enterprise software and then you can replace it with something else later. And then, you know, there are a few that stand out where that's not possible. You think of Oracle or Salesforce or now Slack, where it just gets embedded and enmeshed in the company so tightly that you really cannot replace it. This could be that. So that's why it gets a high score, not because there are network effects here.
Yeah. And there's an interesting element to just how it works, right? If you think about something like a Salesforce.com, you can compel usage. It doesn't matter what the consumer, what the end user thinks. The salespeople have to use Salesforce so they don't get their commission. So they're forced to do it. But something like this, something like Storyboard, are people really going to get fired for not subscribing? I don't know. So it really depends on that individual employee behavior. And so I think that there is a whole reason why it's going to be more difficult to switch.
Okay. So good start. You know, could be Blitz scalable. That's an important element. Let's look at distribution.
Here is the big issue, right? The whole point of Storyboard is that it's private to the enterprise. It ties in with their single sign-on and it makes sure that only people in the organization get this. Because guess what? You're trying to convey information to your team and probably a lot of it is confidential. You can't just put it out over a traditional podcast. And so the security is the raison d'etre for Storyboard to exist. But that same security means where's the virality going to come from, right? People cannot share Storyboard. They literally cannot. And there will be
actively discouraged.
There may be some word of mouth because, you know, leaders will talk to each other and say, hey, check out this Storyboard thing. It really made things easier. Maybe there'll be coverage in the press from people like me who are big advocates of doing something like this. But there's just so much friction in comparison to the other things that we've looked at. So it got a 7. And one of the things that we discover when we go through our scoring algorithm is if you have a 9 and a 7, doesn't matter how you do on the rest, you still don't quite get to 80. It's not possible.
You can get there with a 9 and an 8. So if they figure this one out, like, you know, CEOs do talk. And so if there's some way to sort of get the CEOs to talk amongst themselves about this, or they find a channel to these CEOs or something, where, because I think a lot of the podcasting will be the CEO talking to the rest of the company or the executives. So these executives, you know, they do interact at various levels. So there's a possibility that there could be some word of mouth growth here, but it's not going to grow like Hotmail and it's not going to grow like Facebook. So, you know, we just can't give it a higher score than a 7 right now.
Yeah. And that's a shame because we actually gave them very high scores for the rest. So, you know, because of the fact that it's an online service for things like gross margin work, scalability, and operational scalability, it gets a 10 out of 10. It's audio. Audio is pretty easy to deal with. For market size, it also got a 10 out of 10 because this is something that every company should ultimately do. It's something that is very straightforward and it just makes a ton of sense. And then for product market fit, we didn't quite give them a 10. Because podcasting itself is still not universal, but we gave it a 9 because so much of the consumer behavior element of it has already been proven out by traditional podcasting. So this is not just creating a brand new interaction paradigm, it's creating a proven paradigm with some enterprise security layered on top. And so that makes it much lower risk from a product perspective. So with those nine, with that 9 and those 10s, it scores well, 75. But again, not quite to 80. And really the thing that's holding it back is that viral growth or distribution.
Right. So that's, you know, it's a seed round. We'll watch this company. And, you know, if they start figuring that stuff out, then we might rescore it and consider it blitzscalable and approach the CEO and start talking to them about a possible investment. Remember, that's why we do all this, is to figure out which companies we might want to invest in from blitzscaling ventures. We want to approach the CEO, say, look, we know a lot about blitzscaling. That's something you're about to have to do. And you're going to want us as investors. And I know a lot of people want to invest in your company, but you might want to include us in that syndicate because we can really be helpful to you. And so this is the beginning of our process. Is every month we look at the companies that we think might meet that test, and then for the ones that do, we reach out and begin talking to them and see if they're going to be one of the chosen four. We invest about 4 companies a year, so it's a pretty tight filter. But we do want to talk to these CEOs and learn more about the business, and if it really pans out the way our scoring says it should, then it's a real candidate for us to invest in, and we get to engage with them and we get to work with some of the greatest companies in the world. And it's really enjoyable and professionally fulfilling. And we're really glad to be able to do it.
Now, Scott, in addition to looking at the individual companies, one of the things that we do is just look at the industry as a whole. And during the pandemic, one of the things we noticed was at the outset of the pandemic, there was a significant decline in the number of deals being done. Typically, the top VCs that we track and look at do about 100 deals a month. And at various points last year, it got down as low as 53. So for December of 2020, we're exiting the year. The pandemic is going through a second surge. Where does that show up? How did the month come out overall in terms of number of deals?
The month was strong. It was 105, or 104. And so it was a sort of an average month. We've been as high as 120. And as you said, we've been as low as 53, which is actually in November, because November has Thanksgiving. It kind of wipes out a whole 10 days or so of the month. That's a low number, actually. So that was unusually low. And I'm not sure what drove that besides Thanksgiving, but it could have been pandemic related. But now we're back up to normal numbers. And, you know, if you watch the tape, their deals are clicking off. So the deal pace is strong. All of the aggregate numbers for VC investing for last year were quite strong. And so really what we thought when the pandemic hit was that there would be an enormous depression of fundraising, that entrepreneurs would have to really struggle to raise capital. A lot of companies would not be able to raise capital and might not make it through the pandemic. And it was really a little bit daunting to think what might happen. And lo and behold, you know, because remote work became so important, a lot of these venture funded deals did very, very well. And so it wasn't just remote work, it was remote ordering and remote interaction of every kind, social. So it was overall a real, you know, while it was a tough time for the economy as a whole, the tech economy did very well.
Yep. And we will continue to monitor. Again, hopefully vaccines will be available soon. Hopefully Johnson & Johnson single dose vaccine will prove efficacious and be rolled out as well. And we'll be all the way back to normal before we know it. But we're going to continue monitoring. And this is part of the value add for people who are listeners to this podcast. You'll get a sense of how things are actually progressing in the industry.
Good. Okay. Well, so that's a wrap, Chris. And as always, we do this every month, and it's always enjoyable to do. And I look forward to next month.
You know, Scott, one last question. Let's say somebody's listening to these and thinks to themselves, wow, I'm really impressed with the thinking, and I love the companies that are being described. What would they do to get involved with Blitzscaling Ventures, perhaps as a limited partner?
Well, what a limited partner is it means you invest in a venture fund, right? So if you want to invest in our venture fund, that is something that's available to do. And we do have some minimums, and there's a test you have to meet so that you have to have enough money so that you're accredited as an investor. And there's some tests that the SEC sets. So it's not just anybody that can invest. But if this is something you're interested in, then we'd love to talk to you about it. And you can go to our website and click through, and we'll get an email and we can respond. So we'd love to, or you can, I'm Scott at blitzscalingventures.com, and Chris is Chris at blitzscalingventures.com. You could just type that in and start a conversation.
Fantastic. And where can they find the website, Scott?
Blitzscalingventures.com will do it. It's also at blitzscalingvc.com. So if you don't feel like typing quite so many letters, then you can choose the shorter one.
Perfect. Well, we hope you've enjoyed this inaugural edition of the Blitzscaling Ventures podcast. I'm Chris Yeh, and on behalf of Scott Johnson, we hope to see you again soon.